Good evening, everyone. New face tonight. You've been here before?
Once.
One time. Yes. Let's do introductions around.
I'm Ellie. Judy.
Jeffrey.
Samia.
Paul. Wendy.
I didn't hear your name.
Dave.
I'll remember it next time. I'll hope to remember it next time.
I have a lot of names to remember.
It's a lot. This is the book that we're studying. It's called Bendoa. And it's one of the first things that Dogen Zenji wrote, or one of the first teachings that he gave when he came back to Japan from China. And so he's answering questions that people ask. Why do you have to do meditation anyway if you're already enlightened, etc., etc.? So before I go into it, I wanted to talk a little bit about our practice period, because on Saturday we inaugurated our yearly practice period, or our twice yearly practice period sometimes. It's a tradition to set 6 or so weeks aside and up the ante to our practice in ways that we ourselves know best can benefit not only ourselves but our world, meaning our immediate world and our understanding of the world in which we live. The word for practice period in Japanese is ango, and it means peaceful life. And in this era of particularly unpeacefulness, I think it's a very excellent time to examine what that is, what a peaceful life can be. Of course, we can think of being on the beach or in a little cabin in the woods, removing ourselves from the mess and living a purified life in some way, but that isn't what ango means. It means a peaceful life in the midst of the mess. It really means a peaceful mind. To discover the peace of our mind and cultivate it so that wherever we go, we bring peace with us. That's a different matter from hanging out on the beach. So I want to encourage everyone to use this notion of a peaceful mind and a peaceful life as a challenge. Study it. Study it. Look at it deeply. Look at it hard to see what it means in your life, in your mind. We each of us have different challenges, different issues, as they say. But in our instinct is to know best what's where our wisdom lies. And so our job, really, as serious practitioners is to develop our wisdom and our compassion, which are two sides of the same thing. So if we start digging for wisdom, make sure you're digging for compassion at the same time. They're twins, joined at the hip. So there are a couple of sort of very short questions that we've come to, question 8 and question 9. Question 8 is why, when many people had already gone to China before Dogen, and they brought back Buddhism to Japan and introduced it and created temples and had the whole ritual and the whole kit and caboodle, but they didn't have meditation. And the question is, how come? How come they didn't do that? And Dogen says, they didn't have a chance. They didn't have a chance to meet Zazen. They got all the ritual, but they didn't get, they got the teachings, and they were using the teachings, and it was wonderful, but without meditation, they were missing the essential element of the practice, of Buddha's practice. Dogen said the time was not yet ripe. People weren't ready. And it is strange when I think about my practice and those I know, it happens that way. There's a ripeness that comes and suddenly you are in it in a way that is hard to explain. Just like an apple. You know, you go from a little bud to a flower, and the flower turns into a piece of fruit. We don't know how we come to this. It's a natural process. So question 9 was, did those teachers comprehend this Dharma? So it's the same question, really. If they were teaching it all the time, did they really understand it? And Dogen says if they had understood, it would have been introduced. Meditation would have been introduced. Because that's the foundation out of everything else. All of Buddha's teaching was based on the experience of meditation, which he experienced under the tree. So Uchiyama Roshi said, he would say, no, those guys didn't understand Zazen at all. So. So there is a very interesting question about life and death, about dying, and what is it that dies? Uchiyama Roshi said ancient people must have had a deep fear of dying, and it seems to me that there's a huge fear of dying in our culture as well. So the question is, someone said, do not grieve over life and death. There is an instantaneous means for separating from life and death. It is to understand the principle that mind nature is permanent. This means that even though the body that is born inevitably will be carried into death, still, this mind nature never perishes. If you really understand that the mind nature existing in our body is not subject to birth and death, then since it is the original nature, although the body is only a temporary form, haphazardly born here and dying, the mind is permanent and unchangeable in the past, present, and future. To know this is called release from life and death. Those who know this principle will forever extinguish their rounds of life and death, and when their bodies perish, they will enter into the ocean of original nature. When they stream into this ocean, they are truly endowed with the same wondrous virtues as the Buddha Tathagatas. Now, even though you know this, because your body was produced by a delusory karma of previous lives, you're not the same as the sages. Those who don't know this must forever transmigrate within life and death. Consequently, you need comprehend only the permanence of mind nature. What can you expect from vainly spending your whole life doing quiet sitting? What's the point if the mind is permanent? The mind is continuous. The mind is a separate being from the body. It's what most people believe, I think. It's what the idea of heaven is based on, that there's a spirit of us that continues, and some people believe that there is a heaven and a hell, and that once we're finished with the body, we go somewhere, and that's a permanent condition. And in many traditions, we better behave really well or we'll go to the bad place and we'll suffer forever. It's very scary. It is truly frightening for children. And people carry that fear for the rest of their lives often, that terror of what's going to happen. And even without a traditional religious explanation of heaven and hell, I had a friend who, when she became very, very old and was dying, was terrified to die because she was afraid she would see her parents again. She thought she would have to go wherever they were and be with them, and I never knew why. Something horrible must have happened between them, and she's hung on to life through thick and thin. It was amazing, because she couldn't bear the idea of ending up back there. So Dogen's reply is really important and very wise. So he says, the idea you have just mentioned is not Buddha Dharma at all, but the fallacious view of Seneca. And Seneca was an Indian philosopher who was alive at the same time as Shakyamuni Buddha. He said, this fallacy says that there is a spiritual intelligence or a soul in one's body which discriminates love and hatred or right and wrong as soon as it encounters stuff, and has the capacity to distinguish all such things as pain and itching or suffering and pleasure. And when this body perishes, the spirit, soul, nature escapes and is born elsewhere. So, although it seems to expire here, since it's born somewhere, it's said to be permanent, never perishing. Such is this fallacious doctrine. However, to learn this theory and supposed Buddha Dharma is more stupid than grasping a tile or a pebble and thinking it is a golden treasure. Nothing can compare to the shamefulness of this idiocy. To consider the view of mind as permanent and the material form as impermanent is the same as the wondrous Dharma of the Buddhas. And to think that you become free from ordinary life and death when actually you're arousing the fundamental cause of life and death with this idea. This is pitiful. Just realize this is a mistaken view. You should know that fundamentally in Buddha Dharma, it is affirmed that body and mind are one essence. As we sit, we have to know this. We do experience it. What happens in the body happens in the mind, and vice versa. And science is getting closer and closer to the details of how that works. So even the biota in our gut is affecting how we think, affecting our intelligence. There isn't any extra. It's just this whole system at work, in one place and one time, at one. He said this was similarly understood in India and China, so the idea of it hadn't arrived in Japan yet. In the gate of speaking about impermanence, all dharmas are impermanent. Essence and material form are not separate. You should completely awaken to life and death as exactly nirvana. You can never speak of nirvana outside of life and death. You can't speak of nirvana outside of life and death. Although you have the illusory idea that the understanding that mind is permanent and apart from the body is the Buddha wisdom, distinct from life and death, still, the mind with this discriminating view is itself arising and perishing, not permanent at all. Isn't this idea ephemeral, insignificant? It's just one more idea. You must savor that the principle of oneness of body and mind is just the everyday talk of Buddha Dharma. You should understand that in Buddha Dharma, what is called the Dharma gate of the vast total aspect of mind essence includes the whole vast Dharma realm, the whole entire world of phenomena. Without separating essence and appearance, and without speaking of arising and ceasing, from life and death up to and including Bodhi and Nirvana, there is nothing that is not mind essence. All the myriad phenomena in the entire universe, without exception, are nothing other than this one mind, with everything included and interconnected. These various Dharma gateways are all equally this one mind. Saying there is no difference at all between essence and appearance is exactly how Buddhists understand mind essence. So in this one Dharma, how could you discriminate between body and mind, or separate life and death from Nirvana? As you are already Buddha's child, do not listen to the blabbering of maniacs who preach this fallacious view. He pulled no punches, this guy. So Uchiyama Roshi said, only after we awaken to life, which includes living, aging, sickness, and dying, can we live with true meaning. That's the meaning of this question and Dogen's answer. Only if we can embrace the whole of it. Even Martin Buber says, even in its horror, we see Nirvana. But he says, since people see death from the ground of desire for existence, dying is only a painful and sad matter. So people consider Buddhism to be pessimistic because it considers living, aging, sickness, and dying. This Uchiyama says, simply because life involves dying, life can be a vivid reality. If we only think of existence and neglect thinking of death, our life is like a plastic flower. It doesn't die, but it has no fragrance, is not animated, and bears no fruit. Gradually, it will become filthy and will be thrown away. So it's that impulse to make nice, to make everything as good and pure and perfect as we possibly can, without realizing that we're creating a dream world rather than living in the actual world as it is and as we are. And so although it sounds harsh and difficult, it actually isn't that way at all. I know most of you have heard my story of when I knew this, when I was at Green Gulch, having just finished a whole round of radiation treatment for cancer, and feeling I was closer to death than I'd ever been before. And Coben had asked me to sew this robe. And as I did it, I had a companion. There was a man there who was a costume designer from San Francisco, from the Castro, who was sewing a black robe with golden thread, which Blanche gave special permission to do. And he had to be infused. He was dying of AIDS. So he had an infusion thing. So at lunchtime, we would hang out in the grass at Green Gulch, beautiful, beautiful place, and just marvel at how wonderful it was to be alive. It just felt fantastic. Not in a la-da-da kind of way, but just in so moving and so precious and so dear life. And that's what Dogen is talking about. That's what our life is. Life in the middle of the mess. Life as the sharp edges that we call samsara is nirvana. So I think this is the most important piece of this whole teaching of Bendoa. Talk about essence. I think it is the essence. Uchiyama Roshi says, transmigration in samsara or reincarnation was not Shakyamuni's teaching. Such a belief was Indian folk religion from ancient times. True Buddhism teaches us to be released from transmigration. So, are there questions, comments? Jeffrey?
I had not heard your story, your Green Gulch story, so thank you very much for sharing that with us tonight.
You're welcome.
Those of us who hadn't heard it. I was curious to know, did the fellow who was putting together the Black Book, was he able to finish it before he passed?
Yes. We both finished it in a week. A whole thing in a week. Yeah. And he received his. I gave mine to Coben, and then it disappeared for 3 years.
Oh.
And then at a memorial service for somebody's grandmother, It suddenly showed up.
Well, that makes the story even sweeter.
It does, doesn't it? Yes, Dave.
I'm a little hard of hearing, so I have. That's why I asked you to repeat what you said. I wanted to apologize for that, for one thing. For another thing, I didn't quite understand. You said that nirvana is. Can't speak of nirvana except in terms of life and death.
Yes.
Fine. But some people talk as though nirvana continues after death.
Yes.
What is it? What is the experience of nirvana after death?
Well, it's wishful thinking, I think.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, I see, okay.
That's my view.
Yeah, me too, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we don't know. Really, we don't know.
That little piece that you gave us last week, and you said right before you passed it, you said you thought it was great, and now you're not sure, but you passed it out anyway.
Mm.
I don't remember the exact words, but I happened to be in the car, so I read it again. It's about Dogen view of people that do yoga and take, well, that's my understanding. I don't know if I understand it right, taking it to an extreme or putting, you know, your leg behind your head or, and there's more that he said about it. But to me, it just, and forgive me, Dogen, and everybody here, it just seems kind of judgmental to me. I mean, if that person that is working really hard to get to put the leg behind the head, who knows what kind of trouble or what kind of life he leads. He probably can't sit. Some people can't sit.
Well, anybody can sit.
Pardon?
Anybody can sit.
Well, not people that are like this always. There are people that are really nervous.
They're the ones who would benefit the most. And are and do.
Yeah, perhaps in short sessions, you know. Not.
But what Dogen was talking about was that if you want to experience Zazen, mm-hmm. or experience what Shakyamuni Buddha experienced, mm-hmm. there's a way. Mm-hmm. And some people think it's one way and some people think it's another way, but what he is saying in that chapter is the best way.
Yes.
Zamai, Ozamai. It's the Ozamai part. This is the best way. If you want to really get there, mm-hmm. this is the way to do it. And that going to all that trouble of turning yourself into a corkscrew or doing so many difficult and challenging things, you don't have to do that. That anybody can sit.
Yeah.
Anybody can. You don't have to be rich or smart or tall or short or anything special. It's just to be a human mind body, mm-hmm. being willing to be quiet for a little while. And that itself is the experience of enlightenment.
I understand that, but still, in defense of, sometimes I feel the yoga or the movement prepares the mind to be quiet. It helps.
Oh, for sure.
Exercise, whatever.
Yeah.
And I agree 100% with you. There's no experience like then sitting. Kind of like if you want to eat an apple, you don't eat an orange to get that flavor.
That's what he's saying.
But still, I have a hard time accepting the way he.
He was so scathing.
The other people. It reminded me of when it's time for election, how the Democrats and the Republicans just dog each other.
They're like, pretty mean, aren't they?
So why even go that route? Why not say, you know, the way to sitting is not doing other stuff, just sit.
Well, you'll have to talk to Dogen about the way he talks about things, because he did do that.
He did do what?
Talk like that. Mm-hmm. He was scathing sometimes in his contempt for people who thought they were righteous and doing the correct thing. Mm-hmm. And I think he was anxious and wanting people so much to be understanding what he was understanding. And he was feverish, he was sick, he had TB. Mm-hmm. And I often think that we hear that in his talk, that he wasn't well and he was in a hurry.
It just reminds me of this practice. I remember once Carolyn Atkinson
mm-hmm.
came to Jigoji.
Yeah.
And when she sat, and the first thing she said, she goes, "This practice is so difficult." It was the first 2 years I was sitting, and I already was hurting and everything, but it's like, yes. And I still believe that. To me, it reminds me of the golf game. You know, every once in a while, you hit a good shot, and it's like, oh, I got it. And then many shots later, and no, you don't got it. The ball is here and here and here. So in defense again of Dogen talking about other people and their approach to getting there, I still feel that it's okay to do other stuff, and that's it.
Oh, he's not saying that it's not okay to do other things. He's
no,
not
but he
saying.
No, he just called it like not even right. I don't remember the word that he said.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Yeah. He didn't mean that, Sam. Yeah. Yoga's fine. Qigong, even better. Did?
Was he married?
No.
He was not.
No.
Wasn't there a Zen founder who was married?
Later on, they were forced to marry.
Oh, really?
In the 19th century, the Buddhist temples became very wealthy, and they wanted to sort of ameliorate that in some kind of way. It became very political. So they insisted that each priest have a wife and a family, and it changed everything. There are still monks, unmarried monks, of course, and nuns, but very few. Mostly they're married and taking care of little temples with families.
Shinryu Suzuki was married.
Yes. Yeah. He was married twice.
Okay.
His first wife was murdered by a monk in Japan. Yeah. A lot of tragic stories. Well, it's 8 o'clock. Yeah. Where did it go? Do we have anything to announce besides Sesshin? I'll be sitting from the 3rd to the 11th?
10th.
Yeah. Monday to Monday of August. At Chikoji. They're ready for us. And it sounds like Carolyn's gotten us ready for them.
Carolyn, Wendy, and Paula, Samia.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
And you.
Yes.
It takes a...
We've all been poking around at it, haven't we?
It takes a village to...
It does. It does.
It takes a song at it, but I'm just a sheen.
Yep. Yep.
Chris.
Yes.
Everyone's doing something.
And it won't stop here either. There's lots to do once we get there. But that's part of the effort of it, is the communal effort as well as the solitary sitting. It's a wonderful combination.
I would like to just say again that people can come one day or part of the day as long as they let
They call and leave a message.
Call Jikoji and leave a message. And say, I will be there, I am so and so, and I will be there tomorrow or Thursday or whatever, and for breakfast and dinner or for the whole day, all the meals, so that the cooks and everyone can plan.
And if you don't have Oriyoki bowls, if you can leave it with the message, that would be great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, everybody, anybody who wants to request a scholarship, the deadline for request is
16th.
I don't remember what day we set.
I thought it was the 16th.
I think it was the 16th.
Yeah. Two more days. Okay. Well, should we do our 1 minute, Sid? Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.